Janet from Clark County.
Frank Cassidy, Ridgefield.
Carrie Tarosha, City of Akron.
Ron Onslow, City of Ridgefield.
Greg Thornton, City of Placenta.
Malia Mosley, Town of Rockwell.
Pete Cappell, City of Kansas.
Paige County, City of Washington.
I'm Michael Torres, Clark County.
Good morning, Pete Bob, with House of Homeless.
Rebecca Weiss, Clark County.
And Samantha Levy, with Clark County.
We have a motion to approve the minutes of March 2011.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 All right,
we'll move on to the 2018 action plan.
Yeah. So this is for your info. It's not an action item. Was it just last week before last? It's all been a blur. We've had done in the office the past week and times before that. The action plan went before the Clark County Council for their approval. This is no new information to what you previously received in terms of what we're going to be funding over the next year. But it has gone before the County Council. They have approved it for submission to HUD, and it's then submitted to HUD via IDIS, and it's under review right now. So as soon as, you know, the process is, they have 45 days to review it. And once it's approved, then we can start working on contracts. But this is what we're funding. The reason I'm providing the poster instead of the 27-plus page action plan is this is really a lot more readable and digestible. But any questions, that's the status of where we're at right now for the next budget's approved. Okay. And I'm actually not going to be the presenter for this. Kate Budd from the Council for the Homeless is here. She's not just going to talk about the point in time count, which took place in January of this year. She's going to be talking about the update to our homeless action plan.
Good morning. As Michael mentioned, my name is Kate, and I serve as the executive director with the Council for the Homeless. We are here to talk about those two key things, and it really serves as a subset of the Clark County Action Plan. The Action Plan for Community Action is very wide in scope, really focuses on those who are living on the street, as well as all the way to helping folks get to self-sufficiency. When we talk about the Homeless Action Plan, we're looking just at the Homeless Crisis Response System. So looking at helping people remain housed in their homes if they're at risk of homelessness, to helping people who are on the street move into permanent housing, as well as meet their basic needs while they're living on the street in a car or escaping from a domestic violence situation. The Council for the Homeless is working on updating our homeless action plan. Clark County has had a plan since 2014, and then even previously before then through different titles. But the 2014, which was adopted in 2015, Homeless Action Plan has really been the roadmap for Clark County to utilize as they're looking at contracts and allocating out different funding sources. Just a quick mention regarding the Council for the Homeless. We serve as the coordinating and planning body around preventing and ending homelessness here in Clark County. We provide leadership, advocacy, and solutions. Through our leadership, we have been convening groups to talk about the update of our homeless action plan. We've also been working very closely with community entities to work to increase severe weather beds that are available during the coldest and most frigid winter nights, as well as working to address the street camping that is happening throughout all of Clark County, but most notably down in downtown by Share House. We also focus on advocacy at all levels of government and employ a number of solutions, most notably the Housing Solutions Center, which is our community's coordinated access and entry to the emergency shelters, as well as the different housing programs that are available in Clark County. Folks can access that through the housing hotline, and so then we just move people depending on what their needs are to available programs. So regarding the Homeless Action Plan, we are working through a number of different avenues to garner feedback from community members, from elected officials, from service providers to better understand what the community sees ought to be done in order to address homelessness. We want to be as holistic as possible when we create this new action plan, because it's really going to be our roadmap into the future as to how funds are allocated and how we go about addressing homelessness. This new action plan is going to have very clear outcomes. It's one of our goals to make sure that we are all working toward making sure that programs that are paid for work well, as well as that they stabilize people for the long term so that they're not just becoming housed and then coming back around and becoming homeless again. We also recognize that this action plan is a state requirement. It's something that needs to be accomplished at least every 5 years in order to receive state funding. So we have been doing homeless action plan forums. We've done 6 so far, and we're going to do our 7th today at 1 o'clock at Partners in Careers. If you're available or you know anyone who's available, please come. Councilmember DeRoschers has been to 2, I think, so far, which has been incredibly helpful. But we also recognize that not everyone can come to a forum. And so we're also going to be doing surveys, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. The forums have been really excellent ways to engage community members. We had one up in Battleground, we had one in Camas, we've had 4 so far in Vancouver. And we've had a real myriad of people come from service providers to just generally concerned citizens, to citizens who want to do more but aren't sure where to start. And we've had very lively conversations, which has been an excellent way to just garner feedback and help us understand what folks are looking to accomplish through our homeless crisis response funding. So I mentioned that we previously updated the homeless action plan in 2014 and it was adopted in 2015. I wanted to make a mention that a number of things have changed since then, and I'm sure that many of you are well aware that our rental costs are skyrocketing in Clark County. In 2014, we were just coming out of the Great Recession, and rental costs were inching up just little by little. A 2-bedroom, 1-bath unit was around $930 at that point. Since then, moving up to 2018, the same fair market rent for a 2-bedroom, 1-bath unit is around $1,320. And so we've seen rents go up by $400 just for a modest 2-bedroom, 1-bath unit. And as a result, we're seeing that people are honestly just free-falling into homelessness. Our Housing Solutions Center is getting calls, on average, about 10 people a day that are newly homeless because they weren't able to maintain their rent as it continued to increase. We're seeing that most prominently with people who are on fixed incomes, so folks on Social Security, folks who have retired or on a disability, maybe folks who have a pension, where they were perfectly fine in 2014. But as those rents increased, of course, their income did not increase at nearly the same rate, and so they just don't have the ability to sustain in their units.
I was going to ask about the age group, but it sounds like that highest increase is coming in more of the retired or Social Security income. Is that accurate?
Yes, we're seeing the highest increase among seniors, and so we look at that 62 and above. That being said, anyone that has a disability and is living with Social Security income, they're definitely struggling, and that's really a secondary population that we're seeing increase. So I also just want to make the point that the employment wages also are not keeping up with the very strong increase in the rental costs. We saw wages rise about 8% in the last 4 years, and that certainly is not keeping pace with the $400 or even more increase that we're seeing in the rental rates. So this is the point in time count chart, and I recognize that it's difficult to see, but I want to point out a few things. Every year, the Council for the Homeless, in partnership with many agencies and community member volunteers, focus on counting the number of people that are living outside in our community. We do this through creating creating teams of people who literally go out and walk the streets of Vancouver. In the outskirts, people will drive and go out to areas where people are known to camp or people are known to just hang out. We work to get better every year to be able to pinpoint where encampments might be and where people might be hanging out, as well as to engage more and more volunteers and community agencies. We also hold Project Homeless Connect on that same day, and it's a one-day service fair where service providers that serve people experiencing homelessness, as well as just people who are low income or struggling to remain housed, all come together to be able to connect with our guests and provide them with the resources that they need. Through Project Homeless Connect, through the street count, and then also through our homeless management information system, we count folks on the street, in shelters, and then also in transitional housing. So in 2017, we found 269 people who were living outside throughout Clark County. In 2018, we saw an increase in an additional 105 people for a total of 374. There's a few key reasons that we can pinpoint that we saw that great of an increase. One is that there's a new program in the community called Safe Park, and this program partners with churches who allow people living in their car to park in church parking lots overnight and then utilize usually a porta potty restroom. In the past, we've really struggled in identifying where people who are living in cars are, just because they are so transitory and there haven't been a place that's sanctioned for people to park. Safe Park provided us with an excellent connection to people, and that increased our count by about 20%. We also received a larger number of people experiencing homelessness from the school districts, which ordinarily encompass families and then youth who are under 18 that don't have a parent in their life. And then finally, we just saw a 50% of that 105, 50% of those folks were just found on the street. And I think if you talk to folks, particularly who reside in the Vancouver area, it's certainly in line with what we're seeing, which is a larger number of people who are experiencing homelessness and living on the streets. Yes?
What do you think caused the drop in the sheltered population?
Great question. So I've actually had a number of people ask me that, and it can be connected to transitional housing vouchers that existed in 2017 that were provided by the Vancouver Housing Authority. Unfortunately, there were significant federal cuts to housing vouchers at that same time in 2017. And so of those 9 housing vouchers, 8 of them didn't exist in 2018.
So there's just less space available.
Exactly, yes. As well as there were fewer people in open house ministries, which also equated to that lower numbers. Yes?
I'm just curious, I see a lot of apartment buildings going up around Vancouver. Do you expect that to alleviate some of the problem or not make much of a difference because of their high rental values?
You know, I'm always hopeful. You know, there is some logic to that trickle-down effect where if someone is living in a lower-cost rental unit, they might move into something that's more expensive. The challenge is that because the wages aren't necessarily going up, people aren't seeing their incomes rise significantly, as well as we're seeing a large number of people from outside the area, whether it's the Portland metro area or beyond, moving to our area because it's considered affordable, even you know, with the rent costs that in our world are extremely high. And so we're seeing that some of those units are going to folks who aren't from the community. That being said, we are seeing that the vacancy rates for rental units is increasing. 2 years ago, we were below 2% for the rental vacancy rate. Now, based on a study that I just was reading, we're up around 4.7% of vacancy rates, which is a significant change and very promising because it just means that there are more units available to the general public. We're also looking at, 5% is a healthy vacancy rate for a community. And so we're inching closer to that point, which is exciting. And we also hope we'll loosen up units so that people who have rental barriers, such as a criminal background check or criminal background or debt that they owe, will be able to find units more easily than they are now. I also, one more point regarding the point in time count is the 105 people, that increase was specifically for individuals and couples. We saw 44 families that were unsheltered in 2017 and found that same number in 2018. And while the point in time count is widely recognized as an underrepresentation of the number of people experiencing homelessness, we were pleased to see that the family numbers remained rather stagnant. And we feel like that is the case because this community as a whole, from public funding to philanthropy to grants that agencies are able to acquire, has seen a significant increase in the number of resources available to families. And so we hope that that stagnancy was a result of those resources stabilizing families and taking them from homelessness to being housed.
Kate, before we move on, one thing I like to emphasize, when we talk about new population coming into the area and that being one of the pressure factors around the rates of homelessness, we're not talking about homeless people coming to the area to, you know, because the appeal of services that are here. What we're talking about is this area is affordable in comparison to San Francisco, to LA, even Seattle. You know, there are job opportunities here, the middle high income job opportunities here, combined with a relatively speaking more affordable cost of living for, you know, middle to middle high income people that's really driving the population change. And that does put pressure on the rental, on the housing market. So.
Yes.
With the growth in the homeless there, and yet we have much lower unemployment, do you have statistics on the actually working homeless because of rent being so high, the percentage of those that might be employed that still just can't?
Sure. The last numbers that I was looking at for 2017 actually showed us, and our information is self-report, however, it tends to be very accurate, that almost 40% of the folks who sought assistance in 2017 indicated that they have at least a part-time job. And about 15% indicated that they have two or more jobs that they're working. And we see that anecdotally where people will come in with two, three, even four jobs. And they're making a fine income. The challenge is that they're just not able to save enough money to be able to move into a housing unit. Yes?
Just in a curiosity thing, is my question is opposite Pete's, and that is, is there a percentage of those who do not want to be housed?
That's a great question.
Are they included in this, or are they kind of considered separate?
So when I hear that question, what I respond with is, I don't believe that there are people who don't want to be housed. What I believe is that there are people that just haven't found a scenario that motivates them to be housed. For example, there are many people living on the street who have had very poor experiences with landlords or with shelters, or just feel like there are some rules that they don't want to follow, and it allows them to just kind of be on the street because they don't want to be anywhere else. And so we found, particularly with Housing First programs, which moves people into housing without having very high barriers and saying that someone needs to do A through Z in order to get in. If we're able to identify what motivates them and provide them with a home that doesn't have those rules that they've been avoiding, then they'll move in. It's incredible. We had someone who has been saying for the last 10 years that they have no interest in being housed. And we started working with them and found out that what motivates them is dance, and that they want their own dance studio. They never wanted their own home. And so we sought out a home that could double a dance studio. That could double as a dance studio. And it had a very large kitchen. And that kitchen had linoleum flooring. And so we brought that person to that home and shared it as a dance studio that just happened to also have a kitchen and a restroom and a bedroom. And they loved it. And they now are residing there, and they've been there for over 6 months. And so it's really just about tapping into what motivates folks and what will motivate them to move into housing. And folks are willing to go. They just want to find a scenario that's better than what they have now.
That person's employed, that person's employed and able to make the rent and manage the property.
So that person, they have a disability. And so they live on Social Security income, and so that rent is affordable to them. And fortunately, the rent includes landscaping and all the utilities.
I was just curious, in the last few years, foster care has really been pushing the extended foster care for youth. Not a lot of youth take advantage of it, but has that helped a little bit with at least the youth population homelessness?
So the legislative change that just occurred allows youth who are age 18 to 21 to opt in at any point into extended foster care, and we've seen that that's been significant. And so youth who, they sowed their wild oats, they got away from the foster care system, which
is difficult at first.
Yes.
Sure.
But then they realize that they're interested in being housed, and so then they'll reconnect. And so we have seen that it opens up more options for youth that are experiencing homelessness.
I was not aware that they could go out and do their thing and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's significant.
Yeah, it just changed this last legislative session.
Oh,
which is fantastic.
That's significant, believe me.
Yeah. So I just want to share a little bit more about our engagement plan for the action plan. We have the forums. We also are going to be doing surveys. And so we're going to have 3 different surveys. One that will focus on just general community members, one for service providers, and then a third for people who are experiencing homelessness. We're going to work with our local outreach teams as well as grassroots agencies to be able to engage those who are experiencing homelessness. But we're really looking forward to that feedback to be able to incorporate into the plan. Those surveys should be out by the beginning of next week, and we'll be sure to send them to Michael to be able to disperse to all of you. Feel free to send out to your colleagues and to your constituents if you think there might be an interest. Lastly, we hope to have a draft of the plan out in early September. Anyone is welcome to provide feedback. We'll have an online form that folks can fill out, and then we will be bringing that action plan to our local jurisdictions. Likely, I might even come back here and present for any additional feedback, and then finally we'll bring it to the County Council for adoption in late September, early October. So if you have any further questions, feel free to reach out to me. I'm glad to answer them. And I also am working on presenting to all the different city councils throughout Clark County, so you might see me again. Sure.
Kate and the Council for the Homeless have been very responsive to us in this action plan process. So the Clark County contracts with the Council for the Homeless to do the community planning. If you weren't already familiar with it, the Council for the Homeless was created, their origin story is City of Vancouver, Vancouver Housing Authority, and Clark County. Coming together and wanting an organization to do the community planning and service synchronization, for this area. And for years now, part of our contract with the Council for the Homeless is to do this kind of activity. And what we, when we did the last Homeless Action Plan in 2015, the original intent was to update it between 3 to 5 years, and we were entering that part. I came to Kate earlier this year with the request that we really start moving and moving fast on the action plan update, because we are getting ready for the next request for applications for housing and homelessness, which are the document recording fees, so not home and CDBG, but the document recording fees that are collected here in the county, plus the Consolidated Homeless Grant, plus the Emergency Solutions Grant, plus the Community Services Block Grant. We do a request for applications about every 3 years that cover those areas, and that funds our human services that really are geared towards fighting poverty. It funds the county funding that goes to the homeless crisis response system, and it funds, what else, Rebecca? I think really housing that's really targeted more towards homeless people. I feel like I'm forgetting something.
Well, the community services block grant just has a wide variety of different types of programs that it will be able to fund to bring people into self-sufficiency and alleviate poverty.
Thank you. So it doesn't make any sense for us to do the request for applications and get the proposals and make the funding decisions. That process is very similar to what you do as a board with CDBG and HOME in terms of reviewing proposals, ranking them, and that's how the funding is decided. The Community Action Advisory Board does that for these other funding sources. It doesn't make any sense for us to go through that process and then 6 months later, a homeless action plan that drives the funding for the priorities for funding for the community to come out after decisions are made. So the reason I'm telling you all this is one, for you to have a little more insight to what the process is. Like, yes, we are soliciting community input. We are engaging in a planning process to come up with the area priorities and needs. And this is combined with the community needs assessment that Rebecca worked on last year to also inform that process. That informs the RFA, which will in turn drive where the funding in the community actually goes. There's a process to it. But the other thing I really want to make you aware of in terms of appreciation to Kate and the Council for the Homeless is we've put them under a very, very compressed timeline. To go from start to a draft report in really a matter of about 8 months, with the amount of community input and analysis required for this, it's pretty intense. And I just want to let you know they've been very, very responsive in putting what a pretty comprehensive community outreach process that you just saw. And I've been to one of the community forums and planning to go to more. I'll be just reading the surveys. I know Councilor DeRocher has been to at least two. I don't know how many more you're planning on going. But I was pretty impressed with my experience in terms of the facilitation and the issue discussion of the forum I went to. So, any other questions with the action plan and point of time count before we go? So the next one is HUD finding inspections. If you got this letter, it may not be yellow with the little sticking up that is on it. If you remember last year when we had the SAO audit of the HOME program, there was one finding around the HQS inspections. We actually corrected it before the auditors left. But the way it works is, when they do the audit and they do a finding, it's a finding and it doesn't get re-looked at. It doesn't get closed out until they re-audit it, the next year. So we had the SAO auditors here again this year looking at the HOME program. The report, the official report is not out yet. My understanding from conversations with the auditors is it's a clean, it was a clean audit of the HOME program. They did re-look at HQS. But separately, we also had to interact with HUD and give them all our HQS inspections that we've done in the past three, paperwork for the past 3 years, what the SEO auditors look at. This memo or this letter is basically them agreeing that that the finding was correct and it's closed out. So I want to make sure that you were aware of that. Secondly, we also this past week had the HUD monitors in our office all week looking at the home program. They go around the county looking at all the different participating jurisdictions on a risk assessment based schedule. The last time we received the home monitoring, it's basically like a federal audit, was 2012, and they just left yesterday. Our exit conference was on Friday, and we are going to have one finding on it, which I'm going to brief you on in a moment, but I'm going to go over the whole thing. For overall management, they said no findings or concerns. It's clear staff and management were extremely knowledgeable and proficient on home regulations and requirements. It was clear the program was under strong management. Program staff were very responsive and they were extremely impressed with the excellent organization of files. For rental programs, there's going to be one finding, which is on the contracts. They had an issue with the duration of the agreement. I will get into that in a moment, but I just want to give you a quick overview first. And they'll be providing some technical assistance on this issue to develop a written agreement that they feel would meet the requirement. For rental projects, no findings. They noted a concern on the lease for Freedom's Path. They looked at two projects, Lincoln Place and Freedom's Path. The lease addendum, they wanted it to be a home lease addendum, and we've already required Freedom's Path to adapt this, so it's not a finding. They have concern that it's been corrected. Financial management, no findings or concerns. He had a comment in terms of backup documentation provided at the two different projects. If you looked at the backup, you liked the backup provided by one of the projects more than the other, and that was the end of the exit conference. The report is on the monitoring visit. It's going to come out between 30 and 60 days from now. For the finding on the rental agreement's duration, the county disagrees with that finding, and actually pretty strongly disagrees with the finding. The federal requirement for the home contracts is that they have to have the contract has to specify the duration of the contract, and the contract has to be in effect for the entire affordability period of the home project. Our contracts do specify a duration, and they are in effect for the affordability period. And you know, they've been looked at. You know, we have a whole contract scheme that includes. Jay Carson's has a JD. They've been looked at by our prosecuting attorney's office. And they've assured us, even since HUD was here, like we asked them to relook at it again, and they've assured us, yes, it meets both of those requirements. Our internal audit lead, Larry Stafford, also disagrees with their conclusion. The monitors that were here, it was pretty evident that they're not, I don't think they would disagree that they're not necessarily experts in contracts overall, but where they took issue was our contracts have what is called a survivability clause, which means that provisions in the contract, and it states so, provisions in the contract outlast the period of performance specified on the contract. That's very common in contracts. And I'll give you, one specific example of that is most contracts that we sign with the federal government even, require us to retain documents and have accountability of files, you know, beyond the period of the actual contract. That's just an example of what survivability clauses are for. It's a provision in the contract that remains in effect and you're accountable for beyond that. So the monitors were not, you know, they were not familiar with survivability clauses or their legality. They, you know, we have a survivability clause. We talk about the period of affordability. We say that the period of affordability, that, you know, what the period of affordability is specified in the contract. It says the provisions apply. But they're like, well, we don't think it has teeth. And legally, you know, we believe it does have teeth. And we use it all the time. It's common in contracts. The other piece that that they took issue with in our contracts is we incorporate several documents into the our home rent agreement. You know, they are part of the agreement, you know, by reference and incorporation. We specify what those documents are. And that includes the covenants, that includes the deeds of trust, that includes the promissory notes, that includes the home regulations. To my surprise, they didn't understand that when you incorporate documents into an agreement, that makes them part of the agreement. So they wanted everything in the home contract. So again, you know, that's an issue that our legal counsel completely disagrees with. We find it very impractical. It would make all our contracts ridiculously huge. But those are the two things they based their findings on. We did give them the feedback in the exit conference that we disagree with finding. And we listed out for them, and you know, you can keep a copy of the memorandum, you know, what their specific issues were and, you know, what our response is. But, you know, all I can tell you is, you know, there wasn't a single, you know, this was not a Michael Torres and Samantha having an argument with the monitors of, well, I don't think this, you know, we're talking about, I think everyone in the county was on the same sheet of music and on, you know, looking them in the eye and nodding them from, you know, our fiscal team, which is pretty experienced, and you know, John Jocola, who's the fiscal manager, the fiscal analyst for home. He's been a prior auditor with USDA. You know, he's been a federal auditor. Larry Stafford has led audit teams in his professional background. Jay Carson and Lynn Mueller, you know, they have decades of experience with contracts, and Lynn came to us from the city of Austin managing their contracts. You know, I have about 20 years of management experience and worked with contracts most of that time. And to me, it was, to all of us, it was, you know, a strong disagreement that these were any issues to start with. My assumption is that when the monitoring comes back, you know, when the report comes back, it is going to list that as a finding, despite the county listing the disagreement. We are asking, I am sending a note to David Foster, who's the program manager for home in the Seattle office today, asking, you know, basically telling them, hey, your finding, as you've communicated to us, your finding on our agreements are based on these two things. And we have our legal counsel has told us, you know, the survivability clauses and incorporating documents into the agreement are legally valid mechanisms to meet the CFR requirements of having the contract in effect its entire period of affordability. Because we have our legal counsel opinion, we would like you to consult with your legal counsel on the validity of both survivability clauses and incorporating articles into agreement. You know, because they're pretty mainstream contracting practices. They're not even fringe, unusual things to see. It might be unusual, you know, my guess is that it might be unusual in the home world, you know, and not familiar to those specific monitors. Stephanie Potts, our CPD representative, we're the first time, you know, she's new to HUD. This is her second year. We're the only home participating jurisdiction. You know, so it would be unfamiliar to her. Michael Clyburn, who was the senior CPD representative, came to her. He works with Spokane County and Spokane City and some other jurisdictions around the state. He has some more experience, but you know, I guess it's not familiar to what he looks at. But it should be familiar to anyone that works in contracting. But I wanted to make sure you were brief and aware of that. I don't know whether that changes anything in terms of risk management, risk analysis for other audits and stuff like that at this point. It's non-financial, it's specific to contracting. That's all I have. Any questions?
So do you have to change your practices yet?
We may. I don't know yet. You know, I think that's going to depend a lot on what comes out of the report. You know, two things I'm really frustrated, like I'm personally very, very frustrated with HUD on this. One of them, I already mentioned, you know, which I think legally, factually, I think they're wrong, you know, and I don't think it's a matter of interpretation. You know, I think that, you know, they could disagree with us saying, well, we don't think it's strong enough for you know, in terms of risk mitigation, in complying agreement with, complying enforcement, it's not strong enough in enforcing the period of portability, which I would also disagree with, by the way, because that's the point of the deed of trust and the covenants that run with the property. You know, I mean, like, we have layers of enforcement mechanisms, the least strong of which is the actual home agreement. So, you know, so on one hand, I think they're factually wrong and they're legally wrong. But the other piece I'm really disappointed with in our CPD reps on this is throughout the whole monitoring period and even before that, we've always communicated to them and practiced it in action, is we're willing to change what we do if they feel it's necessary and there's a better way. You know, we haven't been stubborn of like, nope, this is how we're doing it, stay out of it. Because, you know, and I really do believe this, our job, you know, our job number one is to meet the intent of the program and get that good work into our community to make the difference in our community. But a second and hugely important part of our job is compliance, you know, and ultimately compliance, you know, they're the arbiters of compliance. It's their program, you know, so if you tell me, if it's your program and you tell me, well, I think to meet this, you need to do this, we're going to change our practice to that. In the exit monitoring, one of the reasons we're making this a finding is because that's legally a finding is the only mechanism we have to ensure that not only you respond, but you change the practice. I don't even think that was necessary from a compliance standpoint because they heard from myself, they heard from Sam, they heard from our contracting team, they heard from Harold Raines, who's our compliance officer. If you want us to do something different, just tell us. And, you know, right now we're working on the draft contract for Isabella Court Phase 2. Even throughout this monitoring, Sam has been talking with Stephanie Potts, our CPD rep, on, like, you know, what would you like to see in this contract? So, you know, so my anticipation is, yes, we're going to have to change some practices. I'm really, really hoping that we can convince HUD that not only they're wrong, I mean, that's just a factual piece, but that what the changes they're asking us to do aren't unnecessary. Because I do think it's not good. You know, what they're asking us to do is not even best practice in contracting.
It's somewhat concerning.
It is.
Everything you described is common to all kinds of things, and I hope it's not filtered into other federal monies, like transportation dollars.
I hope not.
We're already wary of federal funding.
Yeah. Well, so my for what it's worth, my impression is that this is an issue that I hope is correct impression, but my impression was this is an issue that's isolated to the HUD Seattle office. I hope that's the case, in terms of CPD. Because these are such mainstream and prevalent practices in contracting, and there's legal precedence for enforcing these things that, I mean, it would be absurd. So, but anyway, that's my update in terms of the HUD monitoring visits. Any questions? Overall, it went well. It went really well. And actually, there were, don't get the impression. I mean, the reason I've dwelled on this is because that's, it's a finding. It's what I should be dwelling on. But I think just as importantly, they walked away pretty impressed with the program, honestly. And every time, and they mentioned, the management and the files and organization and that, all that kind of stuff. All I can tell you is that's a reflection primarily of Sam Whitley and the support, hopefully the support that she gets from Rebecca, from myself, from the contracting team, et cetera. But, and Janet as well, thank you. But as you know from working with CDBG and Home, Sam is the point on those things. And she, we went through every single exhibit that the monitors were going through before they got here. And we had everything ready for the tab. That was, a lot of that was led, spearheaded by Sam, so she really got some credit for that. Okay. Next is 2019 applications. Any last questions before I go to that? We're almost done. So what I wanted to talk about with the 2019 applications, we're going to do the RFA coming up in October. It'll be a similar timeline to last year. But I'd like to talk between now and October about TBRA and just propose something for you as UCPB to think about. If you look at our action plan and you look at the homeless housing assistance, between CDBG and Home, we funded almost $1 million of housing assistance, which is great. Most of that is in the form of TBRA rental assistance. The CDBG portion is the piece that we put towards case management. But we funded 4 TBRA programs. At least two of those providers are, I wouldn't say they're struggling in getting that funding out, but I'm not convinced they'll be able to do it in the timelines that they propose. Partly because of the volume of the TBRA assistance, and partly because of the home requirements that come with TBRA. It makes it, out of all the forms of rental assistance we do, is a little bit, it's probably the most inflexible. And, internally in staff, as we have discussions and brainstorm how to make things better and more efficient for the community, we're really thinking about, would it be more practical to only fund, to before the application comes out, to say we're going to fund 1 TBRA program. Go ahead, Sam.
One thing I wanted to mention is also at the same time, the City of Vancouver Affordable Housing Fund was released into the community, so that's helping a lot of people with rent assistance, and the document recording surcharge fee that we were just talking about was increased by the state legislature, so that will be also helping with rent assistance.
Correct.
Programs.
Correct. So this past legislative session made document recording fees, which is the primary source of funding for the homeless crisis response system. It used to have a sunset that would come, every 3 or 5 years, kept pumping out to different random dates. But this last legislative session eliminated the sunset, so that's now permanent, which is fabulous for local homeless crisis response systems. And it increased the funding, by our estimates, it's going to increase the funding by about 60% a year, which is amazing. And I don't want to dismiss the fact that all, you know, that Vancouver having the Affordable Housing Fund plus the increase in document reporting fees is still, you know, like the system is still under, so much stress that it needs all that and could use more funding. Okay, so I'm not, you know, don't misunderstand what we're saying, that the increase in document reporting fees solves all the problems and we no longer need TVRA. But the influx of dollars for rental assistance in the compressed, you know, in this short time span is hard, is a challenge for our service providers to manage. That's a reality. And I think that there may be value in defining a limit to the number of types of proposals that are available for TVRA. You know, the number of types of proposals, and maybe even thinking of a dollar limit to that, so that hopefully more proposals go in towards creation of affordable housing and affordable housing projects, as opposed to rent assistance. So, you know, there's going to be more discussion on that. I mean, this is meant more as a primer to, you know, to think about it. But, you know, we did fund four this last five. Thank you. This last session, you know, the city of Vancouver, you know, asked, you know, after we funded this last round of TVRA, actually reached out to me, Peggy Sheehan, and said, you know, why are we funding so much rental assistance? You know, and I looked at the numbers and I gave her the feedback. You know, the community needs all the rental assistance is getting, and honestly, it needs more. I don't know that TVRA is the best. I think it'd be more effective to reduce rental assistance going out to the community in the form of TVRA and increase rental assistance going out in the form of document reporting fees. I think that'd be more helpful to our nonprofit providers.
Quick question on the document reporting fees. So the legislation that we have for local jurisdictions to maximize that fee, and they don't assess the fee at the state level, do they?
No, they.
So right now
our treasurer is the one that collects and receives the.
But who decides what the fee is? Didn't the legislation provide an additional opportunity to the fee?
No, that was a provision in one of the earlier versions of the bill. The what passed is an increase that's throughout the state for all
so
the.
So that decision was made.
Correct. And assessment collection started on that June 4th. So, and the way we work is we collect revenue from 1 year and make it available for funding in existing contracts the next year. So, what is collected as part of the fee that's, you know, that already started June 4th will be incorporated into the request for applications that go out, with along with projections of what the revenue will be over the next 3 years.
And you have the flexibility with this particular revenue source that you can shift it to more affordable housing versus rental assistance, or?
Well, so one thing about, so yes, in terms of home dollars, not so much in terms of the document reporting fee dollars.
I understand that.
Yeah, so in terms of home dollars, we're not talking about changing what our current allocations are. We're talking about next year's application. So we've not even done the RFA. You know, we absolutely have the flexibility in terms of do we want to ask for specific types of proposals that meet the national objectives for home and CDBG. As long as they meet that, yes, we can ask for what we feel we need in the community.
When's the deadline to make such decision?
October 1st is when we're going to be putting out the request for applications with the proposals due between December 1st and December 15th.
So realistically, you need to know a couple months.
Our Our next meeting right now is on the schedule for October.
So you're already going to have
We can have more discussion on this. And that's by our annual plan. So we're meeting in October. We were thinking about maybe doing the meeting in September internally. Which, if we need further discussion, yes, I'll schedule a UCB meeting for September. If you're feeling that this completely makes sense, we don't need to discuss it more. I'm happy to move forward with the assumption that we're going to move forward with the guidance that we would create our RFH for one TBRA proposal. And if we do a dollar limit, what I would do is email to all of you, what we're thinking in terms of if we're going to have a dollar limit, and if there's any item, if anyone feels that requires further discussion, we can meet in September to decide on that.
Do you think it needs to be dollar and a number, or just dollar?
What do you think, Sam? We still debate it internally.
Well, honestly, I'm thinking it'd be nice to just have one TBRA provider that maxes out our home request at $250,000. The problem that we're seeing right now, especially, is these newer providers to the home program are really struggling. You didn't want to say struggling. I will say they are struggling to meet the requirements, figure out how to calculate the income, figure out how to calculate the rent, figure out how to do the home unit inspection. There's all this stuff that's going on and that they have to do that they're not.
Not
really. Yeah, and so if we have two or three people trying to do that with $100,000 each, it doesn't make as much sense as one provider that knows what they're getting into and can spend $250,000. That's the other problem is one of the providers has had a contract since 2016 and still hasn't been able to spend out through this year. I extended the contract. It's like they're not performing like they should.
You know, and another addition I'll say to what you just said. You know, there's, in terms of our staff capacity, providing technical assistance to one provider to help them meet all our requirements, and we'll do everything we can to provide technical assistance that any provider needs. But that's very different from providing technical assistance to five providers, you know, in terms of TBRA. So in terms of our ability to technically assist providers in meeting their home requirements, fewer providers is better in terms of our capacity. Any other questions or discussion on that?
Makes sense to me.
So do you want me to schedule a meeting in September, or would you like me to just move forward with one TBRA project, two based on the UCP guidelines, the home proposal limit that's already there?
October is better for me, but
okay.
I'm comfortable with it.
I do have a question. So if we provided money this year and they use the money and the programs work really great, but then we only have it open for one, will that cause any issues if people are familiar with the program on their end and being able to help people?
I don't know. I think that if we do this, we do want to, communicate that to our existing service providers starting now so that they can plan. You know, my biggest concern in doing this is existing service providers not planning ahead so that you don't have a household that is receiving rental assistance right now and they were just assuming this would be a service provider problem, you know, that they should not be doing. But if they assume that because they got funded last year, they're going to get funded, or this year, they're going to get funded next year, and they don't plan their case management, you know, they don't case manage the households so that they either receive a different kind of rental assistance or exit from the program before the TBRA assistance stops. You don't want to be a household that's receiving rental assistance and suddenly a source goes away before you're ready for it. I think we can manage that in terms of, at least we can help the service providers manage that, you know, by planning ahead. But, you know, it's, you know, it could be a potentially a problem. Sam?
The one other thing I'll say is that the 2017 contracts that started in January 2018, these 2018 funds that everybody got awarded, we won't get the HUD agreement until July or August, and then we start negotiating the contract. They'll get the contract September or October. So their contracts will just be starting when the 2019 funds come out. So if they know, they'll have a full program ahead of them when they find out that they won't be able, not everybody will be able to get 2019 funds.
Yeah.
And so far, 4 out of 5 agencies are behind schedule.
Well, that was going to be my question. It sounds like you've got not just problems with 1 or 2, but you've got problems with 4 out of 5.
Yes.
Yeah. So and they're the ones who have not received the funding before.
So does SHARE serve the youth?
No.
Janice Youth serves the youth, and they did just have to pay us back some funding when we went from under their program and found a lot of problems.
And they can, but it's not that they can't serve youth. They just, Janice Youth is specialized in serving youth, and they have more outreach to youth, but it doesn't mean that SHARE could not provide it.
SHARE could work with them.
Oh, we're
if
working.
We can only do one, and, I mean, I get all of that. I just have a personal concern about the youth piece, and it's disappointing to know that they're not.
And
they're a great organization, and just not pulling it off for whatever reason on this particular.
These are very technical funds, and Janice Youth gets other rental assistance funding, so those households that are still remaining on there after their contracts are done could be moved over to other funding sources.
Isn't Janice Youth fairly new as well?
No,
they've been around.
Just the TVRA.
This is the TVRA.
Yeah.
Yes. To home funds, they are.
Well,
that was reassuring.
I've seen a lot of kids housed through their program.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot. So I'm really impressed by the
presentation.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, and I, you know, don't think this is, you know, like, well, we have good service providers in our community. You know, we're talking about these specific funds, and these service providers are new to these specific funds, and as evidenced by our recent home monitoring, I mean, these are, you know, the requirements and the regulations that come with home and CDBG funds are intense, and even the interpretation behind the requirements and regulations can be pretty intense.
Okay. Other questions? Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you.